It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Manforth. Sue Marger is a scientist and conservationist who studies Alaska's streams to learn the impact of climate change. So why did she go on a voyage to Antarctica? The reason is unusual. Sue was invited to join a ship full of women scientists with the goal of learning about themselves and how they can be stronger in their work, rather than studying the extreme environment where they're traveling. I went to meet Sue Marger at her office in Homer to learn about that experience and what it meant to her, and I'll bring you that interview today. After that, we'll stay with polar regions with a segment on the changing landscape of the sea ice in the Chukchi Sea north of Alaska. And we'll have a trail tale about wildlife fears while biking in Alaska. And to close out this Outdoor Explorer, our final installment of the training calendar with Lisa Keller on getting ready for Lost Lake and dealing with injuries in the backcountry. It's all ahead on Outdoor Explorer. Stay tuned. Welcome back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and this segment is coming to you from Homer, where I'm sitting with Sue Marger, who is a science director for Cook Inlet Keeper. Cook Inlet Keeper is a conservation group that looks after the whole watershed of the Cook Inlet. Sue has done a lot of work on climate change and other topics around the inlet and has been on the show many times. And I wanted to talk to her this time because she has done something that's far from Cook Inlet, made this pretty extraordinary trip to Antarctica as part of a well, I'll let her explain it, but it's a program to develop women scientists, right, Sue?
Right. Yeah, particularly leadership skills of women of science of any type of background. This was a program called Homeward Bound, and it was the vision of this woman, Fabienne Dattner, in Australia, who literally woke up one morning having had this amazing dream about a bunch of women in Antarctica learning the leadership skills that they need to help us work through these huge global problems that we are embroiled in right now, and that we're really seeing a lack of leadership overall to solve them, things like climate change and pollution in our oceans, plastics in our oceans. And how do we get women more engaged at the table and part of the decision making? So,
yeah, and this is not like a little weekend workshop. This is like a year long program, and then 100 women basically on a ship. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, there were 77 of us on this ship, and we were women from all over the world. We had 18 different countries represented, so we had about, I think there are 8 of us from the United States, but then we had folks from Venezuela and Peru and Colombia and Italy and France and a woman who works in Kenya and China, all over the place. And we all applied for the program because we felt like we were almost as good as we could be, right? We all were doing important things and felt very passionate about the things that we were doing, but felt like we needed that extra skill set to help us be more effective. And so they have a vision of 1,000 women that'll go through this program. And at the end of 10 years, we will have this huge network of women who are not only engaged with our own local communities and the work that we do there, but also engaged at a much larger global scale and hopefully can be a part of the change that we seek.
Wow, that is really cool. And I know there'll be a lot to talk about in terms of what that networking means and sort of how women approach science, if it's different, and how science approaches women, which I know is different. But I'm also curious about Antarctica. Had you been there before, and how did it sort of strike you?
No, I hadn't been to Antarctica, and I really don't know anybody who doesn't have some dream of going to Antarctica. It is a rare place on Earth that no one owns, that no one lives except on these research bases. And so as a scientist, the idea of going someplace and having it just be a team of researchers running around trying to learn about this incredibly unique place is very inspiring. Homer has sort of a crazy amount of people who actually have been to Antarctica. Mm-hmm. I think there's something that polar excitement is contagious for both poles. And so I think people who enjoy the Alaskan landscape also really can imagine that they would in, like, the ice scape of Antarctica. And for me, I had seen a lot of pictures of the landscape, done a lot of, you know, reading about it, and it's, as you might hope, it is truly otherworldly. It is It is not just Alaska with a lot more ice on it. It, you know, it really felt like a whole different world that you're emerging onto. And part of that is traveling 40 hours due south from the tip of South America to get to the Antarctic Peninsula. That voyage, that time to go across the Drake Passage, I think allows you to kind of let the world go behind you and to open you up to this new world, which is part of the vision. Part of the reason that they wanted this program to be in Antarctica was to give people the opportunity to disconnect, put the phones down. There was not any connectivity. We, you know, we really could put home and chores and work and all those stresses behind us to engage together in that that scape. So,
and then it's kind of a science continent, right? I mean, that science is just about all that goes on there. But you, I mean, it's not exactly your area of research, so you weren't doing like research there. Was there any kind of like work component in terms of things you're studying, or were you just sort of taking in the landscape?
Right. So we were on a tourist ship, which means that we actually couldn't, there were people that were, it was really hard for them not to collect water samples or want to, you know, do some research. But no, we were there to interact with the scientists that were at some of these research bases. So we got to go to five of the different bases, and one of them being the Rothera Research Base, the British Antarctic Base, which is known for some long-term Antarctic research that they've done there. And we also went to the Palmer U.S. Base, which is the smaller of the bases that we have there. And so the research component was that we had groups of us that had spent time over the last year learning about particular Antarctic research and sharing that once we were down there. So we were not just there as you might be on a tourist ship listening to other people lecture you about, you know, what this penguin does or what that seal does. We were there actually to improve our own science communication skills. No, so really. We had learned a bunch that we could then share with this group of, you know, really good articulate women, and so the bar was pretty high, and so I think when it puts you in that mindset, everyone kind of raises their game up a bit. So there were some fantastic examples of how to talk about science in a really engaging way. Of course, when you're talking about penguins, people get it's pretty easy to be engaged. Yeah. They are pretty charming. So
absolutely. Well, I mean, did it give you an urge to do research down there, or to sort of like, because I like you were saying, I know a lot of Alaskans who sort of have been bicontinental and and have gone done done research or worked in those bases, you know, and then come back here, and there's people who really love winter, and it sounds like a really self-reliant kind of world, which a lot of Alaskans are really into. Did you feel any sort of being romanced away from Alaska to do something like that?
Actually, it made me more clear that Alaska was where I should be working. So the work that I do here at Cook and the Keeper is really trying to understand how our changing climate is going to impact our watersheds, our salmon streams, what that means for local communities. And going to a place that has none of those watershed impacts that we talk about here, and yet still seeing this rapid change, made me very clear that this global phenomenon we're experiencing right now and that we have been a big part of creating is exactly what I should be working on, and that I should be doing it in the communities that I love and the landscape that I love. So although I hope I'll get to go back to Antarctica, and I will, you know, seek ways to do that, My heart is here, and my passion for making sure we make some change. You know, this is where the decision makers are in Antarctica. No one owns that landscape, right? So they're not, people aren't arguing over culverts and things that we are here. And up here, there's, you know, really active change on the landscape that we're doing in addition to climate change. So really being part of that conversation, I felt more fired up about.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's one of the things that blew my mind when I first started studying climate change. Wrote a book about it, like, what is it, like 15 years ago, more than that now, is that when we release CO2 from a tailpipe or whatever, it's really all over the world within a year, you know, that the levels of CO2 in the atmosphere kind of even out over the course of a year. And so it's like what we're doing here affects every part of the world. And so you're kind of going to another part of the world, seeing change there, seeing how it's all connected, and then talking to all these other women who are coming from different places and talking about change where they live.
Yeah, that was something that really struck me, is that, because sometimes you hear the argument, well, you know, this is a global problem. What can we do in Alaska? Mm-hmm. We're, you know, it's not our fault, right? This is happening everywhere. Well, when you're with a bunch of people who are paying attention, and you realize that if each of us is an agent of change in our place in the planet, that's how we begin to tackle a global problem, and that it really is about the local decisions that ultimately create change, and that it's really very short thinking to be blaming it on, you know, the rest of the world, especially in Alaska, where we are big carbon emitters. So yeah, it was more palpable to me than ever that the local actions is going to solve the big global problems, but that we have to get going. And so it was really great to be with a bunch of women who were like, I'm ready to get going and to make change. Yeah.
That's really cool. And it's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. I'm with Sue Mauger, who's science director of Cook Inlet Keeper. We're in Homer. And Sue has worked for years on looking at climate change impacts on salmon streams and other ecosystem impacts here in our part of the world. And she took a year to work with a group of 77 women who are scientists from all over the world, and then take a trip to Antarctica and study there and work on their communication skills and understanding science together. And I guess something I just grasped as we were talking a moment ago, Sue, was why women, why from all over the world? It's because it goes along with this climate change thing, right? That this is an issue that involves everyone acting in their own space, but also appreciating what's happening elsewhere. And nobody's going to come along and tell us to do it, right? I mean, there's spaceship. Nobody's driving spaceship Earth, right? We all have to do what we're going to do, or it's not going to get resolved. And so, when you're talking about communication and working with these other women, that sort of becomes really an integrated part of the whole message,
right? And not only is no one going to tell us what to do. In some cases, people are telling us what not. Like, people are actively mm-hmm. working against the things that we need to do to make change. And so, you know, there's been a lot of research about who is going to be most impacted by climate change. And it generally is going to be the poorer countries, but it's also going to impact women more than men. And partly that is because they're the ones that are involved with the collecting of the water and the food and caring for children and some of the most vulnerable parts of our human systems are going to be impacted by climate change. And so women are going to be having to deal with these day-to-day impacts, and they need some empowerment to make change and to convince the likely male decision makers in their community or running their government that they are not that they're not flourishing, and that they need the support and the voice to make some of these changes. So there's a lot of research that shows that women are more inclusive and collaborative in the way that they achieve solutions. And so I think by having women of science, particularly with some of those tendencies, it suggests that you've got real solutions-based thinking, fact-based thinking, but collaborative styles. And that's a little bit different than what we've been experimenting with for a long time with a more male-dominated setup. And one thing that I think is really important is that we're not interested in women taking over the world. Kind of, I know that there's mm-hmm. some, you know, people feel like, oh, if it's a women's thing, then that means it must be an anti-man thing. And I think that's really, really not what any of us are thinking about. What we're really interested in exploring is, what does it look like when you have at least an equal number of men and women working together? How does that change the dialogue and the way that they work together? And we don't really know, right? We don't know what that looks like because we don't have a lot of examples of it. There certainly are a lot of women who are in leadership roles now, but those are women who have been successful in a structure that has been developed by men. And that doesn't necessarily represent what women leadership looks like. And so what is it going to be to have women's leadership styles integrated with the infrastructure we have right now? And it's exciting. We don't know. We don't mm-hmm. really know what that'll look like, but I think a lot of us would agree it's worth exploring because things feel a little broken right now on mm-hmm. lots of levels. And so I'm very excited about this pulse of women who are feeling like the time is now to get engaged, and whether it's in science or in politics or any level of decision making, I think there is mm-hmm. this real sense that now we have a bit of a wave moving, and we mm-hmm. ought to take advantage of seeing what this looks like when we are part of the decision making.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in exploring that sort of personality aspect of it a little bit more. And just as you were talking, I'm thinking, wow, I know a lot of high achieving women, including scientists, who are actually like some of the most competitive people I know, right? So so that there's this range of, it's a terminology of sort of feminine and masculine in terms of like personality types. But I mean, I'm sure on your trip, you must have seen like a range of personality types, including a lot of women in science. I feel like had to be sort of ultra alpha in order to actually make it, to get their tenured positions and make it as department heads. And right. And that's sort of a and that's not kind of what you're talking about. But I wonder if you sort of meeting different people on this trip sort of saw some of those, that range of different personalities.
Yeah, just because we're all women and we're all scientists, we were as broad personalities diverse. As you can mm-hmm. imagine. Yeah. So one of the things that we did in the time before we went to Antarctica, was this self-evaluation process where we evaluated ourselves on a whole long list of qualities. And then we asked colleagues to do the same process for us. So we had our self-evaluation and external evaluation to understand our own leadership styles and then also how people perceive us. And women particularly, tends to be a big disconnect. Women tend to be much more self-critical. And so that most people's experiences were that we our self-evaluation was a little harsh on ourselves, and then people perceived us as much more effective and achieving and mentoring than we perceived ourselves. But that, the sort of self-discovery of how we work in the world, where we excel, but where we're really not excelling, and in a framework that helps us understand that there are certain traits that really are worth striving for. There are qualities in a leader that are universal, that doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman, mm-hmm. people want to work with you and want mm-hmm. to hear what, see the direction that you're moving if you have certain qualities. And mm-hmm. so we spent a lot of time we had our own personal coach that helped us decipher all of this survey information. And ultimately we found that, yeah, there were a lot of women who had really high achievement scores, but they hadn't maybe done enough work on building skills of their teams or, you know, in their lab, that they weren't really as nurturing as you would expect a woman to be, right? But mm-hmm. women leaders, being nurturing isn't really part of the way that we see leaders, right?
Or at least in the sort of the academic world. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think we all have that vision of a guy with crazy hair and a lab coat on is mm-hmm. our science role, right? So when nurturing isn't the first image you have in your head. And so thinking about how being really self-aware of what we're good at and also what maybe we need some work on. And so on the ship, it was interesting because we all came with very different styles. Mm-hmm. We all had things that we needed to work on. And mm-hmm. but it was, since we had all been through that year of self-discovery individually, it was nice to come together and for us all to realize that even though we were all amazing and it really was a room full of fascinating people, we all had a lot of work to do to be mm-hmm. our better selves. And that, I don't know, it was a nice safe space to explore that and to be okay with mm-hmm. the fact that we had work to do. And some of us were 24 and some of us were definitely not 24. Mm-hmm. So there's a big range of mm-hmm. ages. And so I think even if you're not in the start of your career, even as you're nearing the end of your career, there's still lots of room for improvement and taking the time to be a little more self-aware about how effective you're being in the work mm-hmm. that you're trying to do.
You're making me very envious as I'm hearing about this. It sounds like such a growth experience. Talking to Sue Mauger, who is the science director for Coconut Keeper. We're in her office in Homer on this episode of Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. One thing that you said, Sue, that struck me was that talking about how women are more going to be more affected by climate change because they're the sort of ones who are, you know, I guess like working in the fields and harvesting the rice and doing all of these tasks. And I think we're used to, at least I'm used to thinking of sort of Americans and Alaskans as sort of, this is the world. And then there are these third world people off there and they're sort of a little tiny thing off in the distance. But in fact, we're sort of these very, very wealthy, small group of people. And most of the world is living much, much closer to the environment than we are. And I'm just wondering if this experience of meeting all these women from all these different places sort of helped you reconceptualize like who we really are.
I think if you think of yourself as an American versus an Alaskan, you kind of answer mm-hmm. that differently. I mm-hmm. do think that Alaskans have a much deeper connection to place mm-hmm. than the average American. But I will also say that there were many times on the expedition on the ship that some woman from some other place in the world would kind of raise their hand and be like, okay, you guys are really thinking through that first world lens. And the solutions that you're talking about would never work in the place that I live. And those were really good reality checks and to think a little bit more deeply about the limited ways we think of communicating and thinking about the priorities that people have. It's not all about, you know, whether you buy a hybrid car or not, right? I mean, there are plenty of people in this world that, you know, are hoping for a bicycle soon. So really having some clarity about where we as Americans are living on the spectrum mm-hmm. and that to solve the problems, we've got to make sure that we're being a little more inclusive in the solutions. So it was, yeah, I think for me, having, you know, I go to science conferences and I, you know, pay attention to the news. I feel like I'm listening, but I'm realizing what a very, you know, that bubble that we've, mm-hmm. many of us have been aware that we've been in, getting outside of the American bubble was really helpful for me in thinking about the questions that I want to pursue and the solutions that are possible. And I do think that Alaska has great potential for being a leader in some of our solutions, but we need to get busy.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I was going to ask, is how this experience of being on a voyage in Antarctica with these other women scientists maybe influenced your thoughts on your research goals here in Alaska or what you want to find out or your perspective on, you know, what we as Alaskans need to be doing.
Yeah. So that's something when I got off the ship, it was had been a really overwhelming experience in lots of ways, and people I would see like, so tell me about it. What'd you learn? What are you going to do now? And I feel like I'm still in that brewing process, but that for me, the clarity was that if you are working from a place where you have, that you know what your values are and you understand why you're doing the work that you're doing. So I'm working in science in an organization that does a lot of outreach, education, and advocacy. And for scientists, that can be a little bit of an uncomfortable space because we tend to be a little cautious in our words and we don't like to overstate things. But in education and outreach and advocacy, often you need to very quickly get to the point. And I'm working to be a little less sort of apologetic for being an outspoken scientist. And I think in this country and more broadly, scientists have gotten placed in a bit of a box where you are expected to do your research and leave it on the table and leave the room, and you're not part of the conversation for deciding what to do with that information. And I feel like that's something that we are struggling with right now, and maybe why this whole conversation about facts and what are facts has gotten a little out of control. And part of it's because we've asked the people who are fact-based thinkers to leave the room after they put the facts on the table, and that we need to be a little more engaged in the social conversation going on about climate change, about and lots of other issues. I mean, there, you know, equity around the world, you know, economic equity, social. There's a lot of conversations that need to be had right now, and so I do feel myself, especially as I'm getting to the later part of my career, to just be a little more bold in my engagement in some of these hard conversations, and to push myself to be unapologetic for having the experiences that I can bring to the table and be part of that conversation without feeling like, well, I'm a scientist, I'm not supposed to say anything once we get into the social conversations. Yeah. And I think that's really a shame. And I think it's something that will take time in science to change, because it's a real culture that you experience as you go through grad school, being told that you stay out of the headlines. You don't want to be part of the media, because then your words will not be your own. And there's definitely a conversation to be had there. But if you're disengaging all of your young scientists from being part of the problem solving, then we're not going to solve climate change fast enough.
Yeah. I mean, as a science journalist, it what you're saying is very resonant. And it's also not just engaging in social policy, but being prepared to be a little bit more assertive in saying, like, what's happening in front of us. And I think of, this, what seems like extreme rapid change that's happening in Kachemak Bay and South Central Alaska, as we see, you know, like all the sea stars died, and where are all the mussels? And just a whole series of very rapid changes. You know, people are not fishing in the Susitna drainage this year.
Anchor River is closed.
Anchor River, just a whole series of rapid, extreme changes. And I don't think scientists are, to a large extent, are kind of temporally lined up to be able to say, well, we don't really know, but we think it could be this, Well, it makes sense if climate change, it's sort of making some statements that could be useful in the public realm.
Right.
We don't need to know 5 or 10 years from now, right?
Right.
So, and you're kind of on the front line of that.
Well, and I think the, it's okay if you're not sure, and the way to respond is to be a little more cautious, I think that's okay. Like, there's it's sort of a do no harm, right? If we think that we may be pushing a system too hard, but we don't know for sure, well, if there's a way to back off a little bit and give us time to see the results. And the challenge is, there are people that are relying on, the jobs that system is, supporting, you know, there are certainly more challenges, but I think by scientists saying, well, we just don't know enough to say, I think is really there's no reason that you can't say the information is leading us to this conclusion. We've got a lot of uncertainty, or we have very little uncertainty, mm-hmm. and to provide that context and not be afraid to at least mm-hmm. to be in the conversation. And I think for a lot of scientists, they just rather not be part of the broader conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a real shame, because I think science minded people are they're very thoughtful, and they like a lot of context around what they do. And those are important skills mm-hmm. to bring to the table.
But at the same time, you're talking about working in a collaborative way and developing community and developing a sense of equality as we communicate with one another about these things. And that's very appealing to me, because that sounds like that's kind of a model for addressing climate change. That maybe hierarchical kind of model is not going to be what it is. It's going to be each individual doing what they can do. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you sort of had from this Antarctica trip with the 77 other women, that was kind of a take home about that sort of, like, there's different ways of dealing with one another?
One of the most poignant experiences I think I had was the process of developing guidelines for how we were gonna interact with each other on the ship. So we spent some time deciding how we wanted to be treated and how we wanted to feel and how we wanted to treat ourselves on this kind of intense experience. And our number one, the first guideline, was to be kind to yourself and to others. And as simple as that sounds, it's actually a very hard thing to achieve. Mm. And there are numerous times that we had to point to it and say, okay, remember that. And some, mostly because we weren't being kind to ourselves, mm-hmm. and that we were not giving ourselves the room to think, feel, say what we wanted. And it makes me imagine what it would be like to live in a world where we all agreed as humans to be kind to ourselves and to others. What a different world it would be. And yeah, it's something I've, like, increasingly am trying to keep in my head as I, you know, whether it's working with other scientists or going to the grocery store or whatever it is, that it would be a very different world if we all just were a little kinder to each other. So it's a funny thing to come away from going to Antarctica. There's so many things you could get from that mm-hmm. experience. But ultimately, it's just, and to be a little kinder to yourself, you know, mm-hmm. We are our own biggest obstacles sometimes. So,
yeah, I mean, good. I mean, for a scientist on an outdoor show, it's a great unexpected message.
Yeah. Right.
Well, thanks so much, Sue. Is there anything you'd like to add, or any final thoughts?
Well, one thing that I've been thinking about is we did a lot of strategic thinking on the trip, and that doing a lot of strategy planning. And that it's all really rooted in your values. And how does this process not just become a New Year's resolution? And, you know, we make a bunch of, like, oh, I want to do this, I want to do this. And I realized that for me, one of my values is related to the joy I get from being outside. And that if I can tie all of my, field work, my work, provides me an opportunity to be outside. If I create opportunities in my home life, it brings all the other, those New Year's resolutions of being more active and seeing my friends and all those things. It pulls it all together. And so I have a lot of hope that this process has kept me grounded in those values that will make this something that carries on for many, many years, and that it isn't a one and done kind of experience mm-hmm. at all. And I like that being outside is a huge part of what grounds me, and I think why Alaska is my home.
Yeah, cool. And that it's sort of all this place-based work. That's okay. That's what we're gonna do. This is where we live, and this yeah. is what we're gonna try to take care of. Yeah. Yeah. Great. Oh, thanks so much for being with us, Sue.
My pleasure. Thanks, Charles.
So I was with Sue Mauger here in Homer, Alaska. The show is Outdoor Explorer. Stay with us as we continue.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
It's well established that Arctic ice is changing in dramatic ways. As the climate warms, ice coverage is decreasing, the amount of multi-year ice has gone down significantly, and in Alaska, many communities are seeing the ice come later and leave sooner. Ravina Koenig of Alaska's Energy Desk recently took a trip on the sea ice off Utqiagvik and has this report on what some of those changes look like up close.
On an early evening in late May, about a dozen grad students and postdocs are standing at the northern edge of Utqiagvik, bundled up and waiting by a fleet of snow machines for one man to rumble their way.
Which way is Barrow?
Were you thinking of that line the whole way here?
Everyone?
This is Dr. Craig George.
Craig George has been a wildlife biologist with the North Slope Burrow since the early 1980s. He spent literal months of his life on the ice in this part of Alaska, often camped out for days or weeks at a time, doing bowhead whale counts and helping to measure and sample whales during spring whaling. The other voice belongs to Andy Mahoney, an ice researcher at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He's been coming to Utqiagvik for the past 18 years to study sea ice.
Craig was there at the very beginning of my sea ice career, and I think...
During the Pleistocene.
Back in the Pleistocene, yeah. Back when ice used to be ice.
Yeah,
before this new ice that we've got now.
George and Mahoney are leading a group of science students on a snow machine trip out onto the Chukchi Sea. We whip over snow-covered lagoons, down the slope leading to the ocean, and over several miles of relatively flat ice close to shore. Then the surface gets rougher. We start to see big piles of broken ice. These are pressure ridges. They're created when big chunks of floating ice bump up against the shore-fast ice we're snow machining on, forcing it to crumble and push both up above the surface, which we can see, and down below it, which we can't. I asked Craig George how what we're looking at is different from what he saw out here decades ago.
The ice tells you what it's made out of when it formed. I mean, the ridges, see the thickness. So that's relatively thin first year. I haven't seen any multi-year.
Multi-year ice is ice that survived at least one summer. It's usually several feet thicker than the ice that forms and melts away in a single year.
First and second year ice looks like the Rockies, Rocky Mountains, and the old multi-year ice looks like the Appalachians, sort of rounded.
A few decades ago, 61% of the ice on the Arctic Ocean was multi-year ice. Now, it's about half that. No. One reason that multi-year ice matters is that it's one of the ways the Arctic stays cold. Ice reflects heat from the sun, while water traps it. So if a ton of ice stops being ice during the summer and instead becomes water, the Arctic is going to get warmer, which means it won't be able to help keep the rest of the Earth cool. We clamber up a 20-foot pressure ridge. Before us is a seemingly endless field of ice rubble, sharp blue shards jutting up in every direction. No rounded Appalachians here. The lack of multi-year ice doesn't just mean that certain shapes are jagged when they used to be round. Andy Mahoney says it helps explain why the landscape looks different in other ways.
These ridges that we're standing on, there would have been more of them and they would have been bigger. So it really has changed. I mean, you look back at some pictures of that era and the features that we now see, they're sort of something of a shadow from the past.
There are other changes too. The ice here is forming later, and in some places this year was record thin. But that doesn't necessarily translate to a bad ice year for people who depend on the ice, like hunters. Yes, it means the window of time to hunt certain animals is shorter, But when it comes to the ice conditions that make for a good whaling year, wind, currents, and weather play a huge role too.
Weather plays a big factor in our hunt, and this year the weather was pretty windy.
That's Joseph Levitt, a whaling captain.
Pretty windy, but we had our ice stayed solid. There was hardly any current on the ocean. And so it turned out to be a good year. At least we got eight whales.
Billy Adams is a whaler who works for the North Slope Borough Wildlife Department. He says that, yes, ice is freezing later, and yes, parts are thinner. But even as they see changes in the ice, whalers are adapting.
We just make changes to how we're going to hunt and when we're going to hunt. That's the biggest thing.
Even as the ice continues to change, whalers say they will keep finding ways to bring whales home to the community. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Ravenna Koenig in Utqiagvik.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Now we have another installment from our Trail Tale series with mountain biker Nancy Felton speaking in downtown Anchorage about the animal hazards and having an active imagination.
So one thing you should know about me is that I'm kind of an anxious person. And this doesn't make me that nervous. I don't really mind talking to all of you because this is okay. But I worry about things, and I get really nervous about things. And one of those things is animal encounters when I'm biking. And some of them are just because I have this really active imagination, and some of them are kind of reality-based. But so I do a lot of what if? We were biking in Colorado on this bike trail, and it was hot and sunny, and so the snakes were out, and I almost ran over this snake. And then I'm thinking to myself, what if that snake got caught in the spokes and it was going round and round, and then I couldn't get off my bike because it was gonna strike. And I mean, it's just you know how you're riding and there's this dead animal on the road? And so I'm always thinking maybe that animal isn't really dead. Maybe it has one last breath and it's gonna come up and get me as I'm going by. So I always give these wide bursts. Now, so far, none of them have risen from the dead, so I've been okay. But I still always kind of go way around. But then there are really fears. I mean, legitimate, moose and bear, especially in Alaska. And I mean, we've had our bear encounters. We were riding in Montana on the highway, son, and we had to get to the top at a certain time. And there's this bear that's just not moving other than towards us. And finally, we were able to flag a car down that kind of aided us as a shield so we could get around. And then we were on the Denali, the park highway, and we were having just a great ride. We're coming back. And then there's this bear, and Chris is Nance, there's a bear. And I'm yeah, I see it. So we kind of do what you're supposed to. You get off your bike, you kind of stand there, and the bear is kind of ambling towards us. And then we're kind of going backwards. And I'm Chris, I'm too anxious. I can't handle this anymore. I said, let's just get on our bikes and just go the other way. I thought, I'd rather have the bear attack me when I couldn't see it than have to look at it while it was getting me. So, and then there are dogs. I don't really enjoy the chases. They're just not my favorite thing, but it's kind of inevitable with biking. And when we were doing our cross-country trip, we had to bike through Washington through a reservation. And the res dogs are known to be chasers and kind of aggressive. And the other thing, it was a Sunday morning, and I think Sunday mornings make you the most vulnerable to dog attacks, because one, there's not much traffic, so there's no cars to kind of distract the dogs. The dogs have had all night to sleep, so they are revved up, ready for someone to just come by. And then it's usually cool. In the afternoons, they're kind of like sunned out and lethargic, but not in the morning. They are like ready. So we've made it through about 2/3 of the reservation. I'm feeling a little good, but you know, I've got my dog anxiety going, you know. And then all of a sudden, these two pit bulls just like come charging at us. I mean, they were so scary. Their teeth are hanging down. The slobber is coming out. They're barking. So then I start riding like a wild woman. I'm like riding on the left-hand side of the road as far as I can. I'm like, I don't even care if a car hits me. I'd rather be hit by a car than these dogs. So somehow we outrode them. I'm not quite sure how we did it, but we did. And it was funny because later that night we met some other cyclists who had done the same route and they talked about the same dogs. So there are some animals that I haven't even thought about to be nervous about. I mean, now I have it on my nervous radar, but I hadn't really thought about it. When we were in Western Australia, we were told to watch out for magpies. And I'm like, magpies? I mean, they're loud and squawky, but like, what do you have to worry about magpies? Well, the magpies in Western Australia like to dive bomb cyclists. And they said, make sure you never look up without eye protection because they can like peck out your eyes. So the first couple days, we didn't have any magpie encounters, but you know, I'm always listening just in case. And so then it's like we're riding along and all of a sudden this magpie just like flies across in front of your face and you're just like, what? And then you, when it hits your helmet, you're just like, so, I mean, magpies can be very disorienting. And, you know, when you're loaded up, your bike isn't as stable as when you're just freewheeling it. So, but we never looked up, so we kept our vision the whole time. And then this other thing in Australia that I hadn't, like, I used to think they were so cute, emus. So emus are kind of like ostriches, but they're a little bit smaller. But they're like, they can be 6 feet tall. So I always thought they were really cute. And I remember we were riding this one day and they were way off in a field. And I'm like, oh, it'd be great to get a picture. You know, you take a picture and they're like this little dot in your camera or whatever. Well, be careful of what you ask for. Because, so we're on this ride. We go to this reserve. We're having lunch at a picnic table they had. And we see these emus. And then they get a little closer. And then they're like really close. And it's like, ooh, ooh, like, you know, like get away from me. But he really wanted my sandwich. And you know, there's all these signs that say, do not feed the animals. And it was just like really, really scary. I mean, like, because there wasn't anything to defend yourself. Like one time we were kayaking in Mexico and we had all these pelicans that wanted to come to breakfast with us. And we're like, no way. We got our paddles out, you know, and we kind of shooed them away. And that worked out perfect. But with this emu, there was no paddle. There was nothing. I finally caved. I gave it my sandwich. And I have never enjoyed emus. I mean, they have these big, beady eyes and these beaks. So anyway, I do not enjoy emus anymore. And you know, there was another animal that I also hadn't really thought about to be concerned about. We were on a road trip with our bikes, and we were camping on Assateague Island, which is in Maryland. And it's a national seashore area, and it's known for its wild ponies. They're like these ponies all over the place. And so we decided to do a ride that afternoon, and we were going to do an out and back ride. And so it was a seashore, it was windy, we had this really stiff headwind going out. So when we turned around, it was like, oh man, I'm like a really good rider. I am going so fast, it was great. And so towards the end of the ride, we had to kind of go up this bridge and then go down. And as we're going down, I am like so happy. I'm like fast, the wind is pushing me. And then close to the bottom, I see that there's these wild ponies on the left-hand side. So I'm like, okay, you know, I got to keep those in mind. You know, they could come out across the road. I need to pay attention. And just as I'm entering the road from the bridge, out of the corner of my eye, I see this. And I'm like, oh, and then that's all I remember. I got slammed with a deer. I just crashed right into me. I don't even remember it. I woke up, you know, like head first, my helmet's cracked, I've got some scrapes. But ultimately, I was fine. An hour later, I could remember my 20-digit calling card, and I knew that I didn't have any head damage. And so from that, I realized you don't have to worry about those wild ponies. It's those sneaky deers to be aware of. So I do get nervous. I do worry about a lot of things, but I really try not to let it affect my enjoyment of biking, and I love bike packing. And if you don't worry about animal encounters, you don't need to start. Rest assured, I'll take care of it for you.
That was Nancy Felton at Trail Tales, an event by Alaska Trails. You can learn more about their organization at our site, outdoorexplorer.org. We're back. It's Outdoor Explorer, and we have another edition of our training calendar with Lisa Keller, an endurance athletics coach. She has Multisport Training of Alaska. She's with us each month, has been for the last 8 months or so, to talk about what to be getting ready for. And we're now very close to the end of the running season for this summer, and so we were going to talk about the Lost Lake Run, which is a trail run, a backcountry run, something we haven't really touched on much before. Mm-hmm. Different from getting ready for a road run or something that's flat?
Definitely, much different. At Lost Lake, you have probably already been spending a lot of time up in the mountains. Just straight out hikes can be part of your training routine. Definitely finding courses that are similar to what Lost Lake is, and maybe even going down and being on that course.
And make sure that people know where it is. You start from, I think it's called the Primrose Campground?
Yep, Primrose.
Yep, which is by Kenai Lake, and you go up in the mountains, then come back down in Seward. So it's a big elevation gain and then big elevation loss at the end.
Right. There are parts of the very beginning where you're definitely maybe even speed hiking up, mm-hmm. so you're not able to run it. So it's I like it. It makes a lot of sense in my head. The race does, because it's like a third of the race is up and a third of the race is rolling and then a third of the race is down. And so it's it kind of makes sense when you're running it. It's like, oh, yeah, I know which part I'm on now, you mm-hmm. know. And it also makes it kind of easy to train for if you can find similar terrain where you're kind of repeating those things.
Right. So you need to do some training of going steeply uphill, because if you overdo it on that section, you're going to have a problem.
Right, exactly. And it really is. This is what's so great about trail runs, is that you can incorporate a lot of hiking. And I think we have the best state park in the nation right outside our front door, where we can just go out there and go for a hike, and that can be part of our training. And it's also really enjoyable to be out there where it's quiet and you can see a view and everything. So I think there's a little bit different feeling for your soul mm-hmm. when you're trail running than when you're road running.
Yeah, and we've got some of the world's best trail runners here in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
absolutely.
With some of our great races.
Yep.
So any differences in terms of how much you would be doing compared to when we were talking in earlier months about getting ready for a flat marathon? Mm-hmm. You can't like go down to Kenai Lake every single time you want to work out, right? So
right.
How do you manage that?
Well, I would be doing, if I was like a someone who is maybe walk running this, and mm-hmm. a lot of people do that, so it might take them 5 or 6 hours to do it. But the great thing about a trail run where you're doing a lot of hiking and walking is that you can go out on a Saturday, and if you want to, spend 5 or 6 hours out there doing that without the associated risk of injury. There's always a risk of injury whenever you're running, but definitely in trail running, in terms of overuse, I think it's a little bit less than on the road. The road is just hard on our bodies. We weren't evolved to run on asphalt. We were mm-hmm. evolved to run on trails. And so I think you can do those longer runs later to the race and decrease your risk of injury that way.
So it's easier on your body because the dirt you're running on has more cushion to it, softer.
Right. And you're also, you have to just to adapt to the terrain. And the terrain may be telling you, you can't run on this, you have to hike on this. And mm-hmm. hiking has less impact than running does.
So there's more variety. Is that just the same thing over and over again?
Yeah.
So what if you do start to feel an injury while you're in a race? It certainly happened to me. And, you know, you've got this
Do I quit? Do I keep going? Do I try to nurse it along? Oh, well, if I try to like lean to my right, it doesn't hurt. You know, what do you do if you start to feel a tweak or something?
Well, during a race is kind of tough, and it depends on where you are. You know, if you're up at the actual lake on Lost Lake and you're injured, you know, it's going to be expensive to get out of there. So you might have to gut it out to get out of there. But if you were closer into town, and it kind of depends on what it is, definitely if you hear like a pop or you feel a big pop, then that is something that you need to stop immediately and go get it checked out as soon as you can. If you have it during training before the race, there's still some strategies that you can use to get through and hopefully make it to the race. Definitely the very first thing you want to do if you feel or hear anything that seems really sudden, there's a sudden onset of it, you need to go get that checked out. If you feel something creeping up on you, so if you're feeling something's bothering me when I'm running, and then it kind of goes away halfway through the run, and then maybe the next week it's starting to bother me the whole run, and then maybe the next week it's bothering me like a day after the run, then you're building a chronic injury. So they're kind of two different things. If a chronic injury, you really have to pay attention to your body and nip it in the bud. And one of the great things you can do is you can get in the water and run. And water running is a great alternative when you're injured and you don't want that impact. So I'm a big proponent of water running to help with recovering or keeping fit during injuries.
What about some other alternatives? Cycling? I mean, are there other things you can do to keep your fitness up while you're waiting for that injury to sort of ease?
Yep, you can definitely, it depends on the injury. I would say pick activities that don't hurt. A lot of knee things don't hurt going uphill. So hiking is great, but the problem is you have to come downhill. Right. So, and that's usually when knee things start to hurt, is when you're coming downhill. Swimming is a great activity. If you're a good swimmer, you might have to be careful pushing off the wall. That would be something on your lower body that might bother you. So, and you can, of course, do strength training, avoiding that area of the injury so you can still keep fit on the upper body. And Pilates and yoga are both great alternatives too.
So, Lisa, we're going to take a little break from our running training segment and maybe switch over to some winter sports training segments, thinking about Tour of Anchorage, which, even though it's only August, is coming up right here in March, you know, and it's not too early to be thinking about it. In fact, if you're a serious skier, you probably are already training for some of those winter things. And then maybe we'll get you back later to do this again, because it's really been fun over the last... we've done it the whole year of talking about this each month.
I would love to, Charles. It's been a blast.
Okay, thanks. Thanks so much. Lisa Keller, Multisport Training of Alaska. That's all for today's show. Thanks again to Lisa Keller for doing those 8 segments over the year of the training calendar. I also thank Nancy Felton, who spoke at Trail Tales, Ravina Koenig from Alaska's Energy Desk, and Sue Marger from Cook Inlet Keeper, who started today's show. Our producer is Eric Bork. Assistant producer is Hannah Duro. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.